for WGTD News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really happy to be sitting across the table this morning from someone I have just met by the name of Dennis Lee Haig. He is a retired history teacher who lives in Lake Geneva. He taught for over three decades at Wheeling High School down in Wheeling, Illinois. Dennis Lee Haig has written a very intriguing novel called The Eyes of the Comet, An American Slave Odyssey. And we're going to be talking with Mr. Haig today about his interest in history, about his interest in this particular portion of our country's history, and about the very, very interesting way in which he has put this novel together, which is roughly set between the years of 1835 and 1843, against the backdrop of Halley's Comet. And but more importantly, it speaks to the deep divisions that were in our country, and in some respects speaks to some of the deep divisions that we are still confronting to this very day. Again, the title of the book is The Eyes of the Comet, An American Slave Odyssey. And Dennis Lee Haig, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. I think ahead of us talking specifically about the book and its plot line and some of its sort of larger implications or ramifications, I would like to find out a little bit about how you came to be so interested in history and eventually decided to become a history teacher. First of all, is history something that was a fascinating subject for you right from the start? I mean, even as a young person?
History has always been my passion. As a little kid, I would get on my bicycle and I would ride out to this. I'm from South Bend, Indiana, and I would ride out to this graveyard out in the edge of town where there was a tree called Council Oak, where LaSalle conferred with the Miami Indians in 1685 for the right of a passage with the St. Joe River there. And that tree was still there. It was intact until I turned 18. Then it got hit by lightning, and that destroyed the tree. But I used to ride my bike out there, and I would imagine the Indians were conferring with LaSalle. And then there was a training camp on the way that I would visit, a Civil War training camp that was behind this old firehouse. So I was always living history all my life, and I had a passion for reading books. And I would read these books, and then it was so great because I could be in Sherwood Forest with Robin Hood. I could be in Shangri-La and the Himalayas, you know, Lost Horizon. And I could go everywhere and never leave my house. So for me, history was just the vehicle for everything. Then I had a passion for collecting pennies, and I would go through pennies and always history all my life.
Just say a word about the kind of satisfaction you got from teaching history and trying to get young people as excited about it as you were, because I think all of us know that it is not a passion that all young people share, that's for sure.
I think that I was fortunate in so far as I was one of these guys that really was motivated to want to learn and learn and learn. And then unfortunately, I got sidestepped when I went into grade school, and I had some unfortunate things happen to me because what I would call defective teaching, and it hurt me. And as a result, I basically shut down the learning process that I should have continued on, but it was really bad. And so I didn't do much. I was lax until I finally got around to going to college. So what it taught me was to have this compassion for the forgotten, as FDR would say. And I was always compassionate towards kids. I wanted kids to realize I understood what they were going through. So I think it probably gave me a bit of an edge in being able to work with kids that were the other, perhaps a lot of teachers had trouble with.
The fact that you yourself struggled as a student.
Yeah, I struggled. I really did. And, gosh, you know, I remember a teacher shaking me because of something. I think I had a little what they would call ADD, and I would have problems with attention deficit. And then teachers would assume I wasn't paying attention, see.
Or didn't care. I mean, you probably weren't paying attention, but it wasn't because you didn't care.
I just didn't care. I was actually, they might go one step further, might think I was being rude to them, see, and it really hurt.
So you went to college and sort of regained your footing as a student and ultimately became a teacher and, as we said, taught for many, many years at Wheeling, Illinois. What ultimately brought you to Lake Geneva?
My wife wanted to go to Lake Geneva or Wisconsin, and I thought, gee, you know, I'm ready for a change. So we came up here because I don't like being mired in traffic all the time. So for me, it was a welcome sight to get out in the rural area, and we live out in the country. So we had horses up until about 3 years ago. We always had horses, and so I really been blessed in that sense.
Well, let's get to talking about this very intriguing novel, which again is called The Eyes of the Comet, An American Slave Odyssey. It has a second subtitle I'm going to ask you about in a moment. But first, kind of give us a sense of what prompted you to sit down and write a novel. You were telling me before we even went on the air that you have never particularly thought of yourself as much of a writer, let alone an author, you know, if whatever the difference is between those two terms. But something must have prompted you to sit down and do this. What's the gestation of this idea?
I don't really know if it's divine or what, but my wife is an inveterate collector. She makes her rounds at resale shops constantly. So one day she dropped off a book, and I read this book about, and it had a lot about slavery and all. And I thought, wow, have we ever really told a story about American slavery? Has it really been told? So my thoughts were I was going to write a movie script. See, originally this was to be a movie script, which I did. But the reason I did it is because I didn't think that this subject had adequately been covered. And there were a lot of biography. And by the way, I want to preface this by pointing out that when I got into this project, like a lot of other people, I thought, well, I'll just go out and find novels about antebellum slavery, and I'll be able to get all kinds of ideas. Well, guess what? I found myself in Virgin Woods because I could find Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom Cabin. Other than that, it was like going along a precipice. There wasn't anything other than biographies, which is not the same as a novel.
Right, so, and I'm curious because as I read the novel, I could certainly see the history teacher in you kind of wanting to get out because, you know, there are many. That's, you know, one of the things I like the most about the book is that you really pass on quite a lot of interesting information. And of course, one of the things you could have done was written a nonfiction book about this period in our country. Instead, you chose to write a novel, a work of fiction, and then weave a lot of facts into it. Why were you so intent on writing a novel?
I'll answer that. And to answer that, believe it or not, that's why I wrote a movie script. Which is strictly dialogue, see? There's no description, so I thought it'd be easier. So that was my endeavor. Because, see, I still lacked that self-confidence at that level. Even then, I was still, I don't know. But then I said, nope, you got to write a novel. So I had to transform this whole thing into a novel. And that's exactly what I did. And to answer your question, as I got into transferring this into a novel, I realized that these fictional characters were a wonderful vehicle for me to be able to convey to the reader the true history of that period. So believe it or not, a biography, and I know that I would probably get some people that would question this, but in my estimation, a biography can be rather limiting because you're limited to certain characters and it doesn't give you the latitude to be able to do a lot, like sort of like the Titanic, where you invest this love scene between these two people, but it's surrounded by all. But Cameron was very accurate in portraying what really happened, mostly what happened, and that's the reason.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting choices you make is to make your central character, this young man by the name of Reggie Marshall, someone who is mixed race, and he is in love with a young woman named Anastasia, who is also mixed race. Was anything in particular behind that choice? Why was it important? Why was it important for the major characters of your novel to be mixed race?
The answer to that, I'm glad you asked that question. And this might behoove people who have an interest in writing a novel. Your protagonist have to have a vehicle to travel. They have to be able to move. Had I taken a protagonist that was directly from Africa, I couldn't put him up north where Reggie and Anastasia wind up. So it would limit me to provide the vehicle that would be able to move the character. So what we have is we have a person who's a slave, who becomes a successful salesman, and somebody who's extremely handsome, somebody that's extremely intelligent. So we want to supply this protagonist with all the attributes that somebody would need to be successful. But as a qualifier, let me point out that the person that really winds up being the star in the movie is a character named Joseph, who was from Africa, who's the one that was put on the scaffold and executed. And if you read those last few chapters of the book, you know where Joseph is at, and you recognize that he is really the hero of the whole book.
Right. And back to Reggie for a moment, the fact is that his being half black and half white does not necessarily make life easier for him. In some ways, it ends up being an enormous, difficult complication for him, and that's also a story that I think is probably lost on most of us when we think about this period.
Miscegenation, the mixing of the races, was extremely common. This has always been a delicate subject, but we know about cases where slave owners took some young lady to the back of the plantation and things went on. And, well, I don't want to explore that subject, but suffice to say, unfortunately, that was very common. But it was intended to be hushed.
Right. And you point out several times in the novel that this reality, in a sense, flew in the face of what was both literally and figuratively a world of black and white, of absolutes, a framework, a hierarchy that was supposed to be crystal clear and beyond question. And this practice, by its very nature, was going to have a tendency to kind of blur those lines, and it made many of the Southerners who engaged in this sort of entrench themselves further.
Well, you brought up a very, very, very good point. I have to tell you, you just hit the nail on the head. Contrary to what people honestly know or believe, American slavery was very, very defining. The slaves had to have their own. They weren't allowed to go to school. They had Negro cloth. Everything was Negro. Negro food, Negro quarters, Negro this, Negro that. And then everything else was white. There wasn't any gray. So there was no room for compromise. Now, if you really want to explore an interesting, and I never got into this subject, but you could take and look at the Germany with the Gestapo. And what they did is they, if a Jew had 1 ounce of, if a person had any trace of Judaism in their bloodline, they were stamped Jewish. They had to make it black and white. And I truly believe in my research, the answer why Germany did that and why these slave owners did that is you have to keep it absolute in order to make the system work. Once you start getting into gray areas, that breaks the system down. And that really affected the American slavery, because what do you do? See, the North had a thing called the ACS, American Colonization Society, which was founded in 1815, which through the years transported about 5,000 free blacks back to Africa. And it was basically an attempt to move black people back to Africa. That's what it was all about. Well, again, it didn't work. But what do you do with somebody that's part black and part white? Does he claim to be an African, or does he claim to be an American? Where do we go with this, see? So it helped break the system down, really.
Right. And, of course, that's a very predominant theme here. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dennis Lee Haig, a retired history teacher who lives in Lake Geneva, and he is the author of an interesting novel called The Eyes of the Comet, An American Slave Odyssey. I want to find out just for a moment a little bit about how you went about writing this book, your first novel, I guess I'm asking more about kind of the writing process, and were you writing for someone? Were you writing for anybody who looked this over, or was this, at least for the most part, kind of a solitary effort, your own?
It was solitary. And, you know, we know that there's, well, let's take a movie script first, and this is applicable to a novel as well, but you have your setup. Then you have what is called the plot point, plot point one. Now, the plot point moves the book from the setup to what is called the main body. But you have to have that plot point. It's like taking an elevator in a building. You go to the building up to a department store, and you want to go to the second floor, you take the elevator. The plot point is like an elevator ride to the second floor. And it has to be something cataclysmic. You know, we watch movies or we read books and we see where something maybe, it's usually about 12 minutes into a movie, something cataclysmic happens. Then we go into the long main body. And then it goes into what is called plot point two. Now, plot point two is another cataclysmic event that occurs probably within the back 20 minutes of a movie, or we could within the book, it's the conclusion. Either way. So you have those five elements. And, well, this is what happened to me. I wrote the main body. I thought I had a nice conclusion. I didn't have an opening. And I studied Harriet Beecher Stowe's. She also wrote a novel called Dread, which was about that subject. So I read Dread and Uncle Tom's Cabin to try to get a wheelhouse on what this was all about, and I couldn't. I couldn't get an opening out of these novels. Now, what am I going to do? And I was in Virginia. Talk about Fort. I'm going to use the word innocuous several times here. I went into an innocuous town in Virginia, and I went into an innocuous antique shop, and I saw an innocuous table with three books sitting on it. That's all this big table had, was three books. So I looked at one book, and it was about growing up in Virginia before the war, and it was written by a lady named Burrell. And I read the book, and it was like, hey, now I know what I have to do for an opening. So that opening in my book was born out of an idea that I got from reading this book that was published in 1893.
Interesting. Your novel opens with, it's a gathering of folks on this southern plantation, and they have company from the north, from Boston. And we are sort of served up very quickly the vast difference in perspective between the typical, let's say, Bostonian and the typical Virginian. And that must have been really fun for you to play with as a history teacher and a student of history, to sort of highlight for us that actually kind of complicated relationship between North and South, which we tend to simplify.
Well, again, I love these insightful points you're bringing up because you're hitting the nail on the head several times. You must have been a carpenter, you know? But what really struck me was the fact that I had a vehicle. Again, I use that word vehicle again. I had a vehicle to move between the North and the South in the beginning. In other words, if I hadn't brought in some Northern, they went to school with the Marshall's kids up in Boston, and I had to bring them in so we would see the contrast between how the North and the South felt about slavery.
And it's interesting, one of the most common themes through the whole book is the really negative attitude that a lot of Southerners had about abolitionists who would come down into the South for the express purpose of trying to seek the abolishment of slavery altogether. Talk for a moment about the reality of this, what abolitionists would do for their cause and what was sometimes their fate.
Greg, again, good question. The abolitionists were primarily for social justice. They were the radical, if we can use that term, radical arm of the people who wanted to have slavery abolished up altogether. Hmm. So quite often they came down for religious motives. Obviously they were not well received at all down South. But interestingly, they were not well received up North as well.
Hmm.
See? No. In fact, Harriet Beecher Stowe would never call herself an abolitionist. She would call herself anti-slavery. But the term abolitionist, unfortunately, had a disparaging connotation to it because it upset a lot of people.
Right.
It really did.
I think some of your most effective writing is when you have some of these especially kind of old established Southerners so deeply resentful of these Northerners who come down kind of holier than thou, trying to mess with a system that they don't understand when, in the words of a couple of your different characters, they have problems of their own they should be, you know, why can't they just stay in the North and fix the things that are wrong with the North instead of coming down here and trying to fix something that's working just fine? I mean, it's really interesting to, and I'm sure it was intriguing for you to try to put yourself in the shoes of, for instance, a Southern slave owner and trying to help us understand the way in which they would see the world and in the way in which they would not see anything wrong with this life and this world.
Well, that's exactly right. And those good old boys, I like to call them the good old boys, they had a definite view, and really they were, I brought this out in the book. In their view, they questioned why Northerners were coming down to bother them. The abolitionists were coming down there and wanting to cause havoc, you know, revolution, insurrection is the word. So they were saying, look, why aren't you worried about the fact that you've got all kinds of problems up North with the black people? They don't. This is an argument that people won't want to hear, but I'll just throw it out there. They would say, look, our black people have a roof over their head. We feed them, we clothe them, we provide medical care. look how many black people are homeless up north. Why aren't you taking care of those people?
Hmm.
See, so there would be arguments that went back and forth. So it wasn't, you could argue, it wasn't just a carte blanche between the North and the South, where the South was all wrong and the North was all right.
Right, and it is simplistic to see the good guys and the bad guys and the evil South and the more evolved North. That misses some really important stories.
And just, I want to inject this too. If you talk to black people today, they'll always say, "Hey, look, don't blame the South entirely. Take a look up north. Look how we were discriminated against up north." So within the black community, they're pretty well aware of what I'm saying right now, that this thing about prejudice wasn't contained just to the South.
Right. It reminds me of some of what Martin Luther King said about how some of the most difficult challenges that he and his movement faced were in trying to confront more sort of insidious bigotry in the North, that and in some respects the more overt kind of outrageous racism that one would see in the South was in a sense something, in a sense, simpler to confront because it was right there, and many Northerners didn't even have any idea of just how bigoted even they themselves were about, along some of these lines.
The nuances of discrimination can be so sublime and in many cases more hurting, hurting.
You also spend some time trying to help us understand how some of these Southerners engaged in the owning of slaves could do so even while fully embracing at least their understanding of the Christian faith. And you talk about an interesting use of terms and the absence of certain terms when for instance, one looks at Scripture. Tell our listeners what I'm talking about.
Well, the Southerners, this is going to probably surprise a few people. In the book, I extolled on this subject. But the main thing that the Southerners used to justify slavery was the Bible. I know that sounds like, what's he talking about? If we look at Ephesians, it says, "Servants, obey your master." And there's it says that directly, but there's more to it. And that was taken to mean that, you know, the slaves have to be obedient to the slave owner. It doesn't point out, they don't point out the scripture about two verses down that says that the slave owners have a responsibility to treat their slaves like equally. Mm. So it doesn't tell the whole story. Cain and Abel, oh my. What happened was, this one's really the showstopper. Noah was in a drunken stupor. And his son, Cain, oh boy, if I have a mental block here, not Cain, Noah's in a drunken stupor. His son comes in and views his father in this drunken stupor naked and just looked at him. And then from this, then his two brothers came in and witnessed their young brother looking at their father, who was in a drunken stupor, naked, and not doing anything about it. They quickly covered him. And then Noah forever condemned his son for not taking action to, you know, from what he had done. And they call that then the Southerners used that against as a justification that the black people were condemned. In the dictionary they use the word blacken. Well, blacken can mean that condemned could be blacken. So blacken is black literally, can be black literally. So they took it upon them to accept the fact that black people were condemned forever in the Bible. So once they could make that point, then they could safely say that black people were inferior to white people.
It's amazing the contortions that one can go through to try to justify such an inhumane system. We should say about the plot line that your main character Reggie, he is actually his father happens to be this slave owner. The man who owns him is also his father. So that is why Reggie Williams is mixed race as he is. He actually has a very close relationship with one of the slave owner's own sons, Albert. And it is because he is very much a personal assistant to Albert, who is frail and confronts other difficulties, that Reggie ends up becoming much more educated than would be typical for a black Southerner. And this in and of itself, although it is helpful to Reggie in some ways, in some of what he confronts, is also a problem because it ends up being, in a sense, a red flag. It stirs up great suspicion among those around him. And we ultimately end up really feeling for this young man the education that has benefited him is also something that is, in a sense, a terrible burden and a real complication for his life.
Greg, you again, you're bringing up another point that has been lost and probably a little bit lost in history. But the problem was that the slaves were not supposed to learn to read and write. That was part of the slave codes in every state, southern state. And there were exceptions that were made, but they weren't, but that was all hush hush. But here we have Reggie, who's 7/8 white, very, very intelligent, very handsome, and he can read and write. Now that puts him to be very, very unique. Wherever he went, he had a lot of resentment that was accorded to him by white Southerners because they realized this guy was way above them in so many ways.
Right. And for instance, early in the novel, when Albert, the son of the slave owner, dies, Reggie is reassigned, and he is going to be reassigned to be a field hand, and suddenly will find himself amongst the field hands with skin of a very different color, and in a sense, he faces rejection or resentment from them. I mean, it's a quandary that most of us would, you know, just can't even imagine. We should say that the novel has us following Reggie as he attempts escape, is recaptured, sold, and then resold, and then resold. And I wonder if you could just say a word about, without going into too much detail, we're running out of time, but just something about kind of the interesting challenge of formulating this story and placing this character of Reggie in the ownership of various owners, because they are a really interesting array of characters.
I am a macro thinker. As a macro thinker, I saw him traversing to different plantations. But I also want to bring out, he winds up north, and he's very successful up north. And I want to point out that one of the problems that I've realized about the study of slavery in America is that we largely put the onus burden on the South, when in fact slavery should be treated as an all-American institution, that the North is more than culpable for the whole system, that it was all, even though it was legal in the South, in what we call a de facto way, it existed up North as well.
Well, and you point out how there were many Northerners who really were helping to facilitate the slave trade, I mean, in some respects.
It's, you know, isn't it a terrible thing, Greg, to have to say this over and over in life? But it's all the wheel for the whole thing was money. Money and power. Doesn't that sound familiar?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. The first subtitle of your book is An American Slave Odyssey. The second subtitle is A Controversial Historical Novel. And those are your words. Someone else didn't decide this book was controversial. You attached that word to your own book. Why is that second subtitle there, A Controversial Historical Novel?
I believe it is controversial. Anytime, Greg, that you honestly sit down with the intent of telling the truth, and the truth can only come about when, I'll give you an example. Let's take slavery as the raw example. You have the Southern slave owners. They have their view of slavery. You have the slaves, their view of slavery. You have the Northerners, their view of slavery. And a fourth category is the difference between the attitude or belief of the male Southern slave owner as opposed to the female Southern slave owner. The women had a completely different view, and it wasn't as kind as the Northern view of slavery. So it's controversial because you're unearthing the truth. But it shouldn't be controversial because you're only telling the truth based upon different views. But nevertheless, for the person who has a prejudiced view in one way, it is controversial, see. Mm.
One interesting choice you make, and I don't know how much about this you want to say, but one really interesting choice you make is that although in many respects the novel feels very believable, very authentic, you have injected this element of almost the supernatural in that Reggie ends up being this man who has visions, very specific visions of a very specific future. I'm just curious why you wanted to inject that element into this novel. His ability, for instance, to see decades into the future to the reality of the Civil War, or to see more than a century into the future and actually have visions of Martin Luther King himself. Why is that here in this novel?
Okay. I'm so glad you asked me that question, Greg. The answer is this. I'm sounding kind of redundant using the word vehicle, but that provides a wonderful vehicle. I think the technical word is a vaccinator, somebody who can project into the future. That's what Reggie was. Think about this. In 1835, he sees the Civil War. He sees Abraham Lincoln delivering the Gettysburg Address, November 19th, 1863. And he's saying, wow, we're going to have a horrible war fought over slavery if we don't do something. So then he's on a mission to try to convince people that we've got to compromise. We got to come to terms with the South and the North, coming to terms to realize what we have to do to prevent this horrible war that's going to occur. So, yeah, that That's a wonderful, see, that's a device. That's a writer's tool that a novelist has that a biographer doesn't have.
Hmm.
Right there's an example of why I like the novel.
Hmm. To close, we should probably say a word about the way in which you see your novel as relevant, as applicable to our situation today, in which I think a lot of people see our country as more divided than ever, or maybe have come to kind of a new awareness of just how divided we are. In what ways are there strong, clear parallels between the world you are describing in your novel and the world in which we are living today?
I think that's the most important question of this meeting, of this interview. The Civil War is, in my estimation, the best example in American history where something occurred, a war between the North and the South, that could have been prevented. Unfortunately, I think I touched on this earlier, the North would not want to pony up the money that would be necessary to pay off the Southern slave owners to free their slaves. That would be a real, real problem. So for some reason, they took the view, historically, outside of Haiti, we've never really had a successful slave revolution where they were freed on their own because of a war. Every time that slavery has died throughout history, it's always died of what you would call, it just died because of without a war.
Almost of natural causes.
Yeah, natural way. So the assumption was that slavery would just go away and there wouldn't be any problem with it. Well, it didn't go away and there was a problem with it. We had a horrible civil war. We should use this is what I want to talk about to other people. I want to get this point across. We should use the Civil War as the crowning example in American history to understand that if we don't look at what's going on today to understand what can happen if we continue to ignore the deep, deep divisions that exist in our country. And as a writer, I could point out just what I've been saying about slavery and that period of history. We could say the same thing about examples of what's going on today. Right now, we could talk about, I could understand why the rich people might have a different view than somebody that's destitute. I can understand how somebody of a different color might have a different view than somebody else. We can go down the line. But what we have to do is we have to bridge those differences and come to terms so that we can do something to make our country great. Mm-hmm. And we cannot sit back and say, well, it'll happen, because that's what they did in 1860. Mm-hmm. And they thought it would just die. And then, of course, Harper's Ferry took place February 61, and then we had Bull Run in 61. Next thing you know, we have a civil war.
Don't want to go down that road again. The book again is called The Eyes of the Comet, An American Slave Odyssey, and it's by Dennis Lee Haig. If people are intrigued and want to look at the book, what's the easiest way for them to get a copy?
They can get a copy through Barnes & Noble. They can get it on Amazon. Actually, a lot of people are using Kindle. That's what I'm being told.
Okay.
It's okay, as long as they read it.
Right. Again, the title is The Eyes of the Comet. Dennis Lee Haig, it was great to meet you and great to talk with you about your very interesting book. Thank you so much.
Greg, I was impressed with your questioning. I really was. Mm-hmm. I just, very professional. I mean that.